This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's path with an S.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm John T.
And I'm Jackie P.
We're continuing our series on the 12 steps today, and today we are on step 10. I wanted to start today with a reading from the 12 and 12 about step 10. And just a reminder, step 10 reads, "We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it." So this is another one of those go inside, do some work type of steps. So I really liked this concept from the 12 and 12. It says, "When a drunk has a terrific hangover because he drank heavily yesterday, he cannot live well today. But there is another kind of hangover which we all experience whether we are drinking or not. That is the emotional hangover, the direct result of yesterday's and sometimes today's excesses of negative emotion, anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. If we would live serenely today and tomorrow, we certainly need to eliminate these hangovers. This does not mean we need to wander morbidly around in the past. It requires an admission and correction of errors now. Our inventory enables us to settle with the past. When this is done, we are really able to leave it behind us. When our inventory is carefully taken, we have made peace within ourselves. The conviction follows that tomorrow's challenges can be met as they come." And then it goes on to talk about some different formats of inventory. And so I wanted to get kind of this, what's the word I'm looking for? The mechanics out of the way so we can talk about the concept a little more. So they talk about the spot check inventory, which can be taken any time during the day when you notice something's off. They talk about the inventory at day's end where you review the day, how you felt, what you did. They talk about the inventories that you'll take with a sponsor or a counselor or a fellow traveler where you'll get current on your progress since the last time that you talked. They said many AAs go in for an annual or semi-annual house cleaning, so kind of a bigger picture, how's my life going, am I on track? And then they also talked about people who benefit from the occasional retreat from the outside world where they can quiet down, be undisturbed, and kind of get centered again. So I liked and I appreciated with AA that right out of the gate, as we talk about step 10, we're not saying this is just in relation to quote-unquote addictive behavior.
Right.
We get emotionally hungover, and it's really the emotions that gum things up. So that's what we want to keep flowing, and that's what we want to take inventory on.
Yeah, just a thought. There's an app out. I think it's called My Spiritual Toolbox. I'm just looking at my phone really quick. And it really... to me, it says My Spiritual Toolkit. So if you look that up, and it does, there's a small fee for it or something like that, I think. But it really, to me, is step 10, because, you know, it allows kind of at the end of the day to, like, if resentment came up, then you slide the kind of the little icon over and say, yes, that came up, and then it has a place for you to kind of journal how that came up and what that was about. And you can even share it, like you could email it to your sponsor from the app and different things like that, which I think can be really helpful because most of us have our phone on us most times of the day, and we can just sit down and if even with a spot check, we can kind of just look at what's happening, you know, are these emotions coming up, what's happening for me, and kind of start to clear it, like it says, promptly.
Yeah, I remember that app. I used it for a while, and I really liked that I could send it off to somebody so it wasn't just rolling around in my head.
Right, yep. One of the things that I saw in the 12 and 12 that I also liked said this, "Our first objective will be the development of self-restraint. This carries a top priority rating. When we speak or act hastily or rashly, the ability to be fair-minded and tolerate evaporates on the spot. One unkind tirade or one willful snap judgment can ruin our relation with another person for a whole day or maybe a whole year. Nothing pays off like restraint of tongue and pen. We must avoid quick-tempered criticisms and furious power-driven argument. The same goes for sulking or silent scorn. These are emotional booby traps baited with pride and vengefulness. Our first job is to sidestep the traps. When we are tempted by the bait, we should train ourselves to step back and think. For we can neither think nor act to good purpose until the habit of self-restraint has become automatic. I really like that, again, because we're now starting to take this outside of whatever the acting out behavior was.
Mm-hmm.
And we're really, you know, it reminds me of our series that we did on functional mature adults.
Yeah.
And this is really getting you to practice those behaviors of being a functional mature adult.
Yeah, the part I selected from the ACA Big Red Book talks about that process of how we change and why we change in mm-hmm. that way through the 10th step. And it reminds me of a concept I'll talk to clients a lot about, that when you start therapy, when you start recovery, you have to get good at doing autopsies.
Yeah.
It's not pleasant. Certainly after you get to the other end of a messy situation, the last thing you want to do is go back and examine the bodies.
Right.
But it's that process of stopping to do the autopsy that builds that self-restraint to where if we'll do those autopsies consistently, it starts getting to the point where in the moment we're regulating.
Uh-huh.
And in the moment we're restraining and we're acting appropriately and in line with our values, instead of this cycle of, you know, big blow up, big embarrassment, big apology,
yeah.
big build up, big blow up, big right. embarrassment, big apology.
Well, and I would say again, like, nobody likes to go back and kind of look at our side of the street and have to clean up the damage. But since that's a trait of being a functional, mature adult, it's a little bit easier when we haven't just like bombed the whole thing and now
yeah.
we're looking at carnage and wreckage. Now we're just looking at, you know, I threw garbage over there.
Mm-hmm.
I neglected some things. If we're going to have to go back anyway, it's better to do it when we've exhibited some restraint
mm-hmm.
than when we've just completely lost it and gone on a tirade and now we have to go back.
Yeah, in the, you know, ACA terms, I think that's a really important part of reparenting ourselves
uh-huh.
is we start providing the functional adult that helps to temper or becomes the frontal lobe
mm-hmm.
for that inner child, wounded child part that will make a big mess if they're left to their own devices, because
right.
that's what kids do.
Right.
So I want to read here from the ACA Big Red Book. This is on page 253. It says, "We learn to spot red flags, which once served as excuses to run from our problems." I love that we start reinterpreting these behaviors as, this is where I need to dig.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before it meant like, I see that, now I'm running in the other direction. I'm doing avoidance. Says, "With step 10, we learn to recognize the cues that lead to fantasizing or dissociation. Many adult children use fantasy, daydreaming, and splitting off to avoid being in the moment. We also learn to recognize when we are obsessing on another person or activity to avoid our feelings or staying in the moment. When these dissociative moments happen, we relax and think about what might have happened leading up to the moment. Sometimes the triggering activity occurred days before or hours before. We stop and breathe, and we get in touch with what's happening. We give our program a chance to work and to meet this challenge. We can make it. We can do this. We can survive our feelings and memories and heal. We often cannot avoid triggers, but we can change the way that we deal with them. We stop dealing with them in isolation. We have help now. We are not alone. We can talk to another person about fears and thoughts, regardless of what they are." So there's that real retraining, that goes on through step 10, and that commitment to, I'm no longer running from this. I'm working on this day by day.
Yeah. And I'm hearing so much again, we talk about this in this podcast, that recovery really isn't just about sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for those who have been listening to these steps, the further along we get, that point really is very clear.
Yeah.
That this really isn't just about stopping a behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And unless we really take the big picture perspective, long-term recovery isn't going to work.
Well, and this is the really interesting thing to me as we've dived deeper into the steps, and I think I've read more about the steps this go around than I have in recent past. When I first started using the steps for myself, I had this concept that it was about arresting behavior.
Mm.
And as I'm reading across fellowships, like, that is not the focus
of
the steps at all. In fact, there's not a whole lot of advice given about how to stop the behavior. That seems to be wisdom that comes more from talking to a sponsor or people in group, like right. the tricks or the gimmicks or whatever that is. The steps are really focused on emotional healing and emotional mm-hmm. work.
Yes, I agree. This from Workaholics Anonymous says, 10th step starts our day and our new way of life from a spiritually and emotionally stable place. We will continue to do things that create problems, and events may happen that can throw our newly abstinent and sane life into turmoil. We are humans, not saints. But we can look back over our day and inventory our fears, false pride, envy, self-pity, and resentments. These are our old patterns of negative thinking. We can inventory attitudes and characteristics that were barriers to joyful, healthy living and reliance on our higher power that day. This is how we grow and change into sanity. I really like that step into maintaining our sanity, which would be our recovery, mm-hmm. is really this everyday kind of process and throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we started off with a certain maybe ritual or whatever. So we're starting from this stable place, and then we keep anchoring back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think having worked the 12 steps to this point, we understand the change that has been taking place in us, what we've been focused on, and how much freeing there is in taking the actions.
I love the concept. Carnes talks about this in The Gentle Path Through the 12 Steps. He says that he talks about different kind of strata of recovery, and I'm going to go into details with those, but just what you're saying, like we recognize our need for this. He says we go from viewing the steps as medicine to we see it as food. Mm. And it's something that we, I don't know if come to terms, no, it is coming to terms. We come to terms with the fact that we're going to need this on a regular basis. So he talks about three different strata of recovery. He talks about partial recovery is where we're no longer practicing our addictive or our compulsive behavior, and we're not in crisis anymore. We've gotten help from a 12-step group, maybe a counselor or a doctor. He said it's a really good start, but it's only a start. In partial recovery, we often take from our program or we take from what's given to us, but we don't do a lot of giving back.
Mm.
And then we have the opportunity to move into convenient recovery. And he said at this point, we're working, we may be sponsoring, we may be giving back, but there's still in the back of our minds, there will come a time where this ends. There will come a time where I'm done with this. And the pain is going to stop at some point, and my recovery work is going to be able to stop at some point. He says that, of course, we never really get to stop because life is about continued change and growth.
Uh-huh.
We don't
go backward, we go forward.
Right, right. And I love, this isn't in this section, but I've heard Dr. Carnes say before that it's a really wonderful day when you wake up and you have problems in your life that aren't associated with sex or whatever your addiction is.
Right.
But you still have problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of what that's the pattern of living that I think we learn from the steps. That step 10 really starts to shift our focus to how do I use this on a regular basis?
Mm.
This is a pattern for overcoming problems.
Right.
This is a pattern for getting through struggle with our values and our soul intact. So he says, we'll never stop rewriting our story either, and we'll often need to revisit issues we've dealt with many times before. And then in the end, we get to what he calls inconvenient recovery. And as I was reading this, I was like, who wants to get to inconvenient recovery? Like, isn't it supposed to be like Golden Gates recovery or something? He says, we no longer look for a way out, a way to declare the process complete. We understand that life will always require us to change, to grow, and to learn. This last weekend, it seems like it was the first time in a really long time my spouse and I got to go out. Just the two of us. We've been busy with vacations and summer things, and so we were talking about kind of how our relationship has changed over the 10 years that we've been together, and especially in the last 3 years we've both been working an active 12-step program.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about some of our concepts of each other that have evolved over time and have developed over time, and we kind of, at the end of that conversation, we'd kind of landed on this spot that's like, I think we're accepting that there's always going to be problems that we have to face together. And there's always going to be something between the two of us that we need to be aware of and that we need to work on. And we were even talking about how those issues between the two of us that we need to be aware of and that we need to work on, how they've traded out over the years.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be this. It's not so much that anymore. Now it's this.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying that if I would have heard this conversation 7 years ago, I would have thought, like, we're not going to make it then. Like,
how depressing.
Right? But we were saying, like, I don't know that there's ever been another time in our relationship where we felt more invigorated and more connected and more excited about our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that is coming from that acceptance. Like, life is going to continue to roll challenges onto our doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to continue to be issues with me, and there's going to continue to be issues with her. But that acceptance that that's the substance of life kind of lets us transcend that crisis or that that like struggle because it's struggle, and more like embrace that here's an opportunity to grow.
Well, and I would imagine that shift has also been able to happen because you guys have skills to deal with whatever life rolls onto your doorstep. And when we know that life's going to kind of keep bringing in these tides, and we don't feel like we have the skills,
mm-hmm.
that's a different panic,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you might get really down about that,
mm-hmm.
because you don't know how to swim and the tide just keeps hitting you.
And I think that's one of the things that, again, would have surprised me 7 years ago, to say, like, there's some basic life skills that you're going to be getting that'll make a difference. Like, I'm an adult.
I have my freaking master's degree. I don't need basic.
I'm fairly functional. But yeah, you're right. Like, there were skills for dealing with day-to-day life that I have not been in possession of for as long as I would have thought I would have been.
I was talking with a client earlier this week about just kind of that built-in, I mean, I think life, like you were saying, life continues to show problems to us, and we're never going to be in this place of nothing, everything goes the way that I want it to.
Yeah.
And the reality is we don't really even want that, you know, because it reminds me of that. There was a Twilight episode, the Twilight Zone episode years ago, and it was somebody like Rocky Valenti or something like that. And he is holding up this, he's holding up this jewelry store, and in the process gets shot. And this character named Pip shows up on the other side in the afterlife and welcomes him. And, you know, and he's kind of saying to Pip, like, give me your wallet. And so Pip hands him his wallet, and he's like, oh my gosh, there's all this money in it. And Pip's like, well, that's not my wallet, that's your wallet. And he's like, well, what do you want? You know, and Rocky's like, take me to your house. And so they go to this mansion, and Rocky's just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is where you live? And Pip's like, no, this isn't where I live. This is where you live. And Rocky's like, wow, you know, and he's like, yeah, like, and he's like, what do you want to do now? And Rocky's like, I want to go to the casino and I want to gamble. And he's like, okay, we'll open that drawer and there's like $2 million inside. And so he goes to the casino and he wins every single thing that he's gambling with. And Rocky's like, this is great, you know. And 6 months later, Pip shows up and Rocky's like, this is miserable. Like,
mm-hmm.
everything I want, I get. And, you know, and he's like, that's not working for me at all. And Pip's like, okay, well, how often would you like things to not go your way? You know, and Rocky's like, that's not the point. And then Rocky says, like, I don't even belong in heaven. And Pip's like, what makes you think this is heaven? You know, and the
twist.
Yeah, it pans back, you know. It's like, again, this isn't, like, we think that when life is smooth and the waters are always, like, placid, that's where we're going to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not really. Like, we need some challenge. We need some struggle. And the way that our brain is designed, like, there's really pleasure when we get through something well.
I need to find the research on this, but I heard somewhere, and it felt like a very credible source.
Okay.
That the neural pathways in our brain that deal with pleasure are gated by pain. Like,
yeah.
There's, in order to experience pleasure in the brain, there is going to be some discomfort or some pain
uh-huh.
to get there.
Well, I mean, I'll acknowledge right now that in high school, I don't think it was just me. There's my denial. No, I know it wasn't me. But I cheated. There was a lot of cheating that happened. Everybody was cheating, right? And at the time, I felt totally justified because I wouldn't have to cheat if the teacher did a better job. Mm-hmm. And I remember one of the favorite teachers, our senior year, one of our favorite, like, he only taught seniors. And so everybody kind of looked forward to having his classes. And at the end of the year, as we're getting ready to graduate, he'd always give this speech in the main assembly, and he'd give a speech to the seniors. And so I had, you know, been 2 years watching the speech he gave to the seniors and, you know, how much hope the senior class brought him for our future and what great leaders they're going to be and yada, yada. And he would give that kind of speech. And when it was our turn to have that senior speech, he got up and he talked about how, for the first time, he was really concerned about the future of our society.
Not
because
what you were expecting.
No, he was like, what the class of 1988 had taught him was that they didn't care about being honest, that if they needed to cheat in order to make something happen, they would do it. Like, I mean, it was like kind of an eye-opening moment, right? And so I remember, in college, I didn't cheat, which was good. But in college, like, there was a different feeling I got when I would get, like, a test back and have a good score.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was me. And I had to put in hard work. And I couldn't just cram the night before. And I had to prepare. And I had to take notes. And I had to listen. I had to do all of this. Like, and it was on me. And then when I would get that back and it had a good grade on it, I felt good.
Yeah.
Whereas before it was just like, oh good,
I deserve.
Well, and it was, that's what I was going for. Yeah. You know, it wasn't because of any internal process I had gone through. And so again, I think there is this, you know, the brain really is wired, and we know addiction teaches us that we can short circuit these neural pathways in the brain and kind of have like the easy button, you know, that Staples does, where we just say reward, reward, reward. But really it's designed that I do a certain amount of work or I struggle and I wrestle with something and then I get a reward. And that's really the positive way of using our reward system in the brain.
Yeah, I think that's the skill that step 10 really calls out, is that ability to take a fair inventory.
Right.
Which means not that we go soft on ourselves, but it means we're upfront and we own our strengths.
Right.
And we also can be real about what's not working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those are some of the biggest growing moments for me. And I think I've told this story on this podcast before, the first English paper I wrote in college.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I got a D-. And I told the teacher, I don't write D-minus papers. And he's like, no, you do.
I'm better than this.
This is a D-. But my high school teacher said I was a good writer. And he's like, that's high school writing. This is college. And then I really appreciate that he said, let me help you with this.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my next office hours. Come by. I'll let you rewrite this.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me feedback that I needed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't easy to hear because I had this protective bubble of like, I'm good around me. And I'm really glad that he popped that.
Yeah.
And even more glad that he helped me to rebuild after that.
Yeah.
And that's something, you know, even recently as I've worked on some things with a business coach, like that's been another part of the process I've had to remind myself, like, no, not everything that falls from your brain is gold. Like,
right.
It takes some refining, it takes some work, and that's okay. You're a better person for this process.
Yeah. I had a similar experience with a college professor who also was kind of like, hey, let's do some work on this and see what you can really do instead of just kind of half-assing it and getting by. Let's go to a gentle path through the 12 principles. So principle 10 is about trust. And it says here, recovery teaches us and sometimes forces us to trust. We learn to trust others. We learn to trust ourselves. We learn to trust an ongoing process of renewal. We give ourselves over to uncertainty, free fall, and the care of a higher power. This is not always a warm and fuzzy experience. Sometimes we trust only because we are desperate or have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
At times we'll be anxious or frightened. At times life will seem to be falling apart around us. But we are learning to live with our fear and anxiety, and to practice courage and trust in the face of them. Meanwhile, our inner observer has learned to stay mindful and alert, steering us away from reactivity and focusing on the next right thing we need to do. This emphasis on doing is essential. Trust is active, not passive. It emboldens us to speak up, to take a stand, to make decisions, and to move forward into a future we can neither foresee nor control. It prompts us to take one leap of faith after another. And I like that focus on trust. And one of the things that I'll often tell clients is sometimes I think we have our ideas of trust are all wrong. Like sometimes clients will come to me and say, I have trust issues, and their goal is to not have trust issues. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell them, well, like, wait a minute. Like, let's remember the world we live in. Those trust issues are there for a reason. And I think the goal of trust is one of learning who to trust and also learning who not to trust.
Yeah.
And so just to say, I need to be trusting isn't really the goal. Like, that may not be the outcome that we need, because you may be trusting and you may trust the wrong people. And now we just have trauma repetition.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, this goal of trusting is to be able to, you know, move forward with our fear and anxiety. You know, sometimes I was one that I have trust issues, but if my fear and anxiety, if I were to think, if I have fear and anxiety, that means I shouldn't trust people.
Mm-hmm.
I really wouldn't have a lot of the great people in my life that I do have.
Yeah.
Right. So I had to learn to own my fear and anxiety and say, okay, these are here and these are always going to be here in situations like this. And I can't just think, you know, oh, since I don't feel good, I shouldn't trust this person.
Well, and stopping and taking a careful look at what the fear and anxiety is saying and what it's coming from helps you to really understand what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we can live so much of our life just kind of going on the surface, like, this is good feeling, so I go. This
right.
is bad feeling, so I stop.
Right.
And it's really a lot more nuanced than that.
Uh-huh.
Like, sometimes that anxiety is the sign that we are making a big investment. And when big investments pay off, that's really rewarding.
Right.
And that's an inherent part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think some of this daily inventory stuff actually gets us more acquainted with what our feelings and what our perceptions
mm-hmm.
and what our experience actually mean. You know,
right.
Like Dr. Kern said, our story is constantly being rewritten. And we need to constantly go back and work on understanding again things that we thought we had down pat.
Right, right.
With that trust comment, I want to look at what Recovering Couples Anonymous has to say about step 10. And I had forgotten about this exercise from Recovering Couples Anonymous. I used to use it a lot with clients. And then it's one of those things that got crowded out of my brain.
Yeah, isn't that weird how that happens?
Yeah. As you were saying the other day, I think it was even some of the PMLD stuff that you had read years ago.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. And then you get focused on something else and you go back and like, why did I ever leave this?
Right. Why did I forget about this?
So it talks about taking a daily inventory where you ask two questions. What has my partner done to help the coupleship?
Mm.
And what have I done to harm the coupleship?
Mm.
I really like the focus there. You know, I think for most of us, we tend to overemphasize the good we do and underemphasize the hurt that we cause.
Mm-hmm.
So I like here that we're focused on finding good in our partner, and we're focused on taking responsibility for the ways that we can hurt.
Right.
And then it says, much of our harmful behavior involves blaming our partner. A daily or weekly inventory tends to reverse this process of blaming. And I think that can be generalized. You know, not just blaming our partner, but I think a lot of our heartache and a lot of our cycles and a lot of the places we get trapped come from us deflecting responsibility off
mm-hmm.
of ourselves
mm-hmm.
And trying to put it on somebody else, which makes for a much cleaner story and lets us off the hook for a lot. But it really, I think, also takes out of our hands the things that we have power
yeah.
to do.
Yeah, I was talking with a client just the other day, and and this client was recognizing the need to do an amends to somebody that's in her current life. And just a lot of, you know, I don't know that she's necessarily done anything concrete to this person, but she's got a lot of, like, the story I'm telling myself is. And we came to recognize that there's a lot of projecting that's happening on this person. Like, a lot of her own mom issues are being projected onto this person, and then that story's playing out. But I think it's kind of a one-sided story, you know?
Yeah.
The other person may or may not have any awareness of kind of the energy that's coming. But so we're just kind of talking through that process and, you know, talking about how difficult that's going to be for her. And then we started to look at, though, like, what is your unwillingness to own the emotions that you're having here? What is that keeping you from, you know, and what are you not getting because of that? And she was really starting to recognize that this is a friend of hers, and she really kind of misses this friendship. Mm-hmm. And she's wondering, you know, how this friendship could have developed over the past several months if this little piece wasn't going on. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't distancing herself, right? And I think that's one of those, again, we talk about working on these, recovery really is getting at us being a healthy, functional adult and also knowing how to do relationships. Where, again, you know, we've talked about before on this podcast how oftentimes trauma happens relationally.
Yeah.
And the healing also comes relationally. But that doesn't mean all relationships are perfect. Mm-hmm. Or every person is perfect. Yeah. And I was saying that's both the beauty and the pain of relationships. You know, oftentimes with our addiction, whether it was a behavioral addiction, substance addiction, whatever, the addiction is always predictable. It's available. It doesn't have its own life that's going on, right? And people really, in those ways, people can't compete with the addiction. But the connection, the realness that people can offer is much more than what any of the substances or the behaviors can offer us. And again, that's both the beauty and the pain of relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to, let's see, is it my turn or is it your turn to read?
You go ahead.
Okay. This is in Sex Addicts Anonymous. This is on page 54, and it says, "It isn't always easy to know when we've been wrong. We may not discover the truth about our behavior until later. When we review our day as part of the 10th step, we find ourselves recognizing actions and emotions that we weren't completely aware of at the time. With practice, we learn how to recognize the feeling in the moment. We gradually learn to listen to the quiet, gentle voice of our conscience and notice from within when something feels wrong. As we continue to take personal inventory, we begin to notice mistakes and hurtful behaviors more quickly." Embedded in there is I read a promise in there that as we get to, as we develop more comfort with this ability to do a daily inventory, mm-hmm. we find that our conscience is actually gentle, and it's quiet.
Yeah.
I think so many people in recovery have a really active and loud inner critic, and that can be one of the things that I think makes it scary to go inside and to really reflect. But that's something that I've seen in my own life, and I've seen in other 12-step circles, that it's part of the, if I can call it, the magic of the steps. Like, there's compassion that comes mm-hmm. out of working this and developing through this that becomes a really automatic thing, and I think that's part of how we make peace with ourselves.
Yeah. Going along with that, from Eating Disorders Anonymous, they say, "When able, we think deeply about our step 6 and 7 work. We let go of our defects and move on. We ask ourselves, what would I be doing if I felt better? And then we do exactly that." Again, kind of that compassion, more of a kind of a still way of learning how to mm-hmm. live, right? Where before there was a lot of chaos and unmanageability and fear and control and all of that stuff that muddied the waters, and kind of being able to slow things down, to reflect, to meditate, to ponder, and then move with clarity, I think is part of the magic of the 12 steps, right? It's part of that new way of living that, again, life doesn't stop being life, but we and how we engage with life changes dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
One other thing from ACA that talks about it says, in step 10, we are making a statement to hang on to the hard-won changes we are employing in our lives. We are living with more honesty and affirmation of ourselves. We realize we don't have to act perfect or flawless to be loved or accepted. We can make errors and laugh at ourselves without feeling shame. We are less fearful of people and their opinions of us. And again, I think that just brings such a freedom, right? That we can look at ourselves as imperfect and see the perfection in being imperfect, right? And to be able to laugh at ourselves and our flaws, not in a way of like degrading the self, but really in lovingly accepting that we are imperfect, and that's totally fine.
And I love that phrase, this is an exact quote, but this is how we hold on to the hard-won gains that we've made.
Right.
I remember early attempts at sobriety, putting some time together, and then like Carnes talks about in that, what do you call it, convenient recovery? No, the one before that. Anyway, whatever the name is, like, just that, like, okay, I got there, I'm done, here's the exit. And I think that's one of the gifts that recovery has brought me as time has gone on. Like, I really value the changes that have happened. And it's like I've learned how to care for my own things the more money and time I get into getting those things or those experiences that I really want. I care for them differently and I feel differently about them because I realize it's not just some cheap transitory thing. I've had to fight hard and I've had to work hard to have that. And so maintaining it becomes natural. And I think that's really, like, I see this, like we talked about last time, like step 9 is kind of cresting the hill and the steps are different here. And as we look at what steps 10, 11, and 12 do, it's really, it's not maintenance mode in the sense that it's like, okay, it's not hard anymore. It's more like, this is about preserving and increasing what I've gained.
That reminds me of the 3-circle sobriety plan and kind of the thinking behind that, you know, that says, so the 3 circles, you've got that inner circle, kind of the bullseye thing is where the acting out behavior is. And then the 2nd circle is about slips and boundaries. And then that outer circle is kind of the yes behaviors.
Yeah.
And the thinking on that is the more we understand what yes means, the easier it is to say no.
Yeah.
And again, as you were talking about those hard-won victories in recovery and the feelings that change, the perspectives that change, the way of living that changes, it's a lot harder to go backwards because we know what we're giving up at that point and we know what that kind of living offered us.
Thank you for listening today. We hope you'll join us next week.
Remember, your story matters. Remember, there is something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story till it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com.
This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
Remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I'm learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.